show. Head on to Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! The week begins anew. This is the Horn. Head on RadioNetwork.com. We are easily found, of course, at the website itself, but also on a number of streaming platforms, things like the TuneIn Radio app and the Stitcher.com app for smartphones and Android devices and iPhones and such like. Other sites, Roku devices, goodness me, Dar.fm, Streama.com. We never know anymore where we're being found because we're just all over the place. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This, like I said, is the Horn. It is Monday. It is the fourth day of March, 2013. Snow on the ground here in the hills and hollers of almost level West Bicod. More expected, if you're in the upper Midwest, you're probably getting what we'll be getting by Wednesday today. Had a lovely start to the day today. Texas Betsy kindly invited me to address her class, which we did via the little technological marvel that is Skype. You'll notice I didn't say miracle. No. This is the hand of man. And we had a lovely conversation. It just warmed my heart. And so I've been in rather a good mood all day. My good mood was somewhat interrupted by the fact that we were not able to get Dr. Bill O'Brien on the air this afternoon. We had some last-minute technical issues that have to be sorted out, and they will be sorted out. I'm going to run over to Dr. Bill's tomorrow and work on finalizing those last few things. And then hopefully we will have him on the air by 4 o'clock tomorrow. And I really, really want you to give Dr. Bill a listen, because this is going to be radio unlike anything you're used to, except to the extent that you're already used to the Horn. And what I mean by that is the fact that it is going to be driven by a desire to facilitate dialogue on real issues relating to the Constitution and American government. Yeah, unlike anything that's being done by anyone else of whom or which I'm aware. And toward that end, I'm going to spend the last half of the program this evening, for those of you who have never heard Dr. Bill, I'm going to spend the last half of the program this evening running I hate to even call it lecture, it wasn't. It was too dynamic for a lecture. But these are remarks that, and you've heard me talk about this particular lecture because I walked out of the room looking like one of those old Maxell Corporation tape posters, you know, the guy sitting in the chair with his head just, with his hair just blowing backwards from the force of the speakers. I felt like that. American exceptionalism is something that the right wing loves to pound on, much like their Bible. They pound on it, but understand it not. Some of you have heard this before. Many of you have not. And as such, I think it will give you a very, very nice introduction to what you can expect from Dr. Bill O'Brien going forward. We will get his podcasts set up, and we will get his live broadcasts all set up. And hopefully you will help spread the word that there is real American history, real American government being discussed out here outside the tawdry talking points of the right wing. And the most beautiful part of this is the fact that it is approachable. This is not some sort of high-blown talking with teeth-clenched theory. Because American history has never been made by those people. It's only been talked about by those people. American history has been made by people whose hands were dirty, whose necks were burnt red by the heat of the sun, and who were, and by people whose hands were calloused, and who wiped sweat from their brows hour by hour of their existence. That's where American history comes from. So, like I said, it'll be about the last half of the program tonight. And I hope you will enjoy listening to it as much as I will enjoy playing it. That does not mean, of course, that we don't have any work to do at hand. For this is, in fact, Moran Monday. And it is as if, well, spring may not have sprung here in the mountains of almost level West by God, Virginia, but hoo-wee! It is as if spring was just busting out all over for the Morans, extending all the way through the weekend and into this morning and up through today. Now, a couple of things, a little bit of house cleaning before we jump into Moran Monday. Or housekeeping, not cleaning. You know, of course, that this is listener-supported radio. You know, of course, that I hate even mentioning this stuff. But it is the only way that we survive, and we came as close in February to having the horn completely just over as we've ever been. And so with that in mind, we have on the table this evening Shirley from Wisconsin's challenge. $100, hopefully to be met by ten of you at $10 a piece, or 20 of you at $5 a piece, however you wish to work it out. But we need to raise this kind of money to keep things going. There are things we need to do but can't do. I need to rebuild the production computer. We need to pay down our credit account. We need to do a number of things. But we need to get the 800 number out of hock. But all these things have to wait until we know that the essentials are taken care of. So the PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. The snail mail address, you know that as well, the Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, West Virginia, 25801. And any checks or money orders, please do not make them payable to Bob Kincaid, as Bob Kincaid never sees it. Boss Man Wayne takes care of the mailbox issues, and they go into the Horn bank account, and then they go to various and sundry people to whom we pay bills. So I'm not around to endorse checks. So hopefully, we will see a determined effort to answer Shirley's $100 challenge this Monday, the 4th of March, 2013. Because that's how we make sure that there's an April. Now, where to begin? Well, in light of everything that's going to be out there, I think we have to begin with this.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. Morons.
That's right. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right up. It's Morin Monday on the Horn. You will not believe your ears. You will not believe your eyes. You will not believe any of your other three remaining senses. We have Morins, Morins, and more Morins. Morins all over creation, right behind this thin cybernetic veil of canvas. You will find right-wing Morins, teabag Morins, repiglican Morins, Morins of all sizes, shapes, colors, stripes. Stripes? Polka dots! Morins abound. You can't tell the Morins without a program, and the Horn is the program that tells the Morins. You just can't tell them much. No one will be admitted after the first 5 minutes, and head for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in Morins. Oh, yes, indeed, we will. I hardly know where to start. We're Moran poor this Monday. We have a wealth of Morins. One of them's not even a printed story as such. It just happens to be that, well, because of the way my day runs, I'm usually up later and up later. In other words, out of bed later and into bed later. So, anymore, I don't really see morning news programming. But thinking back to those emails we used to get from our dear friend Maura before she went on, saying, Bob, why do you do this to yourself? Why do you torment yourself? Why do you turn on Morning Joe? It's like a conversation I had with our buddy Scott in Sweden. It's anthropological in nature. It's not really anything to do with trying to find out what the news is. It has a lot more to do with watching in shocked, slack-jawed amazement the workings of what passes for minds sloshing around between the ears of certain right-wingers like Joe... Oh, sorry. Must be my sinuses. Clisutis Scarborough. And he was really on a roll today. For a minute there, I thought poor little Mika was gonna knock the taste right out of his mouth. Apparently, Barack Obama is a big old honking liar. Now, there are some on our side who would agree with that, but not for the obvious, not for these reasons. Because apparently, since the frogs and locusts have not covered the land, since the rivers are not running with blood, the sequester is no big deal. And if you thought he could spell it or actually knew he was doing it, you would say that Joe Scarborough this morning was at his sardonic best or worst. Because he was bemoaning the poor little children who couldn't go to Head Start. And then said, yeah, my kid, you know, day after tomorrow, he's going to come out as kid. Yeah, come on, Joe, we got an idea what you make. Your kid isn't in Head Start. And most of us no sooner believe you've got your kid in public school than we believe that you could fly to the moon, although God knows we wish you would. And it went on like that. What was her name? Nicole Wallace, former loyal Bushy, I do believe, was there to echo him. And everyone seemed to agree that the sequester was that the White House was making too big a deal out of the sequester. Well, the CBO has not backed off of its numbers that 750,000 people will ultimately lose their jobs out of this. And I haven't read a story saying, for instance, that the furloughed air traffic controllers from, for instance, Jaeger Airport in Charleston
are still on the job. What it boils down to is that for a right winger, Nicole Wallace was a not a loyal, well, she may have been a loyal Bushy, but most lately she worked for, she was a McCainiac. But anyway, the sense that I got was, because I was sitting there watching all these well-heeled, well-coiffed, well-paid people talking about how the sequester wasn't touching them. Okie dokie, fine. You don't have kids in Head Start. You don't have, apparently air traffic controllers don't mean anything to you. You're not part of the maintenance and janitorial staff of the government who have been told there will be no more overtime, when overtime was part of how they calculated their ability to pay their bills from month to month. These are not the working class, and I go back to my thesis of a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, in which I determined that I'm going to stop talking about middle class and lower class. No, there's working class and leisure class. Here's a hint. If, for instance, you have a $2.5 million mega RV that you drive around to football games, you are a member of the leisure class. See how it works? Yeah. If, for instance, however, somebody signs your paycheck every week, and maybe you've still got a decent enough job that you get a couple of weeks of vacation a year. Yes, Texas Betsy, there are not just $2 million RVs, there are $3 million RVs. But if you're, you know, if your fondest hope is to maybe get away to the state park at best for a weekend, you're probably working class. But anyway, all those well-heeled, well-coiffed, well-dressed, well-paid experts, with the possible exception of poor Mika, had no more relationship to with working America than a hog does with a lunar mission. And I'm ashamed of myself for even talking about the about that stupid inane program. You know, it's a hack fest from Barnacle to the boy wonder, the boy wunderkind, whose name I can't remember, but for whom they've chosen a shockingly coral color of lipstick. I mean, generally the makeup on men on TV is not supposed to be noticeable, but I think they went with the Mary Kay for him, whatever his name is. I'll remember it in a minute. And then guests like Nicole Wallace to sit and tell us that the president's making all of this up, and that the Washington Post has given him four Pinocchio noses for his statement that teachers would be laid off, or that federal workers were not going to be getting paid. Well, you know what? If you're working overtime and not getting paid, you're not getting paid. Or if you expected to work overtime and you're not allowed to work overtime, you're not getting paid. But this goes back to something that I said last week about the sequester. It is going to be hard to quantify because it is piecemeal in nature. Morning Joe is never going to do a story, nor will most of the for-profit media, about an 82-year-old grandma who doesn't get lunch anymore. The for-profit media are not going to talk about one Head Start center that doesn't serve low-income four-year-olds anymore. Because they have no... They want granny to have skin in the game and four-year-olds to have skin in the game, but they have none. So, that's the reality. If we want to know what's going to be happening via the sequester, if we want to know what's going to, it's going to be up to us to find out. And you know what? It started on March the 1st, but it may not necessarily take full effect for a few more months. Weeks, months, what have you. But the callous approach of people like John Boehner and Joe Scarborough, well, it really tells you where the 1% are in this country, doesn't it? Well, we seem to be okay. What's everyone complaining about? Oh, lovey. We are having lobster for lunch every day this week, are we not? Well, all is right with the world. The Dow up above 14,000. Life is good. Life is good. It's 22 minutes past the hour, and a big, big thank you to Joe from New Jersey. He said, I've never called in or emailed. Donated once before a few months back. Been listening for a while now. Found you via Malloy. Just trying to do my part. I rarely get the chance to listen live, but I can today, so consider Shirley's challenge met. Thank you very kindly, Joe. And thank you to James, and thank you to Grant, who also responded to the challenge. That's wonderful. That is wonderful, because when we get a little bit, when we get it taken care of early like that, that means that maybe we won't have to sweat so hard a day, another day or a day after that, because some days are good and some days not so much. Thank you. Thank you very much. By the way, I'm hoping one of the things that occupied my weekend, we did scrape together what was necessary to install a new router here. And it comes highly recommended from our chat room moderator, Lottie. And so far, it looks like it's doing a pretty good job. I just had a note from Marty saying you had a little bit of buffering, but I don't see it happening from this end. So let us all cross our fingers. Ron in Raleigh points out, he says, the rumor is that that big honking pile of economic knowledge, well, at least you had the big honking pile part right, Ron. The rumor is that big honking pile of economic knowledge, Joe Scarborough, will be debating Paul Krugman on Charlie Rose's Gabfest tonight. This should be interesting. Well, it will be interesting if it is allowed to be the Ali Sonny Liston fight that it ought to be, with Krugman just poised above Joe, daring him to get up and knock him down again. Get up! Get up! But I suspect it'll be much more like a Harlem Globetrotters basketball game insofar as the referee will be Charlie Rose. Sorry. Still, interesting. Morning Joe and Dirty Looks. Jim writing in, he says, have you noticed the look on the face of Jingle Joe's sidekick as he talks out of his rear end? I noticed it this morning. Honest to Pete, I didn't know if Mika was going to look at him and say, I'm not mad, I'm hurt, and stomp off the set, or just go ahead and do what it looks like she's been wanting to do for a long time and just, like I said, knock the taste right out of his mouth. Never know. But yeah, the frustration was apparent. Because the oozing disdain that was coming from him was just shocking. No, it wasn't shocking. Well, it's shocking if you've got a conscience. You know, who gives a damn? You know, air traffic controllers, schmear traffic controllers. If you're flying the plane and you can't keep from hitting another plane, well, you're just not a very good pilot, are you? I've flown into Atlanta a few times, and, you know, it's surprising how close the planes do get to each other. It's kind of nice to have somebody up there that's... Left! No, your other left! It's a little reassuring. So that's a start for Moran Monday, but by no means any kind of a finish. I had a note earlier, before showtime. Ron and Raleigh wrote in and said, I knew something smelled funny. He said, since this sequestration shibboleth came down the pike, I thought that something smelled funny, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it. The following link is to an article by Dr. William Black. You will remember Dr. Black as being in charge of the prosecutors during the savings and loan debacle. The article, in essence, states that once again, Brer Obama is being thrown into the briar patch of his choosing. The sequestration is just a grand bargain writ small. He's able to hang this economic albatross around the necks of Repiglicans because of their intransigence on everything else he's proposed. President not sure is quite sure of one thing. He wants to leave the dismantling of the New Deal as his legacy, and the sequestration is his way of starting the process. And I did, in fact, look at the article, and it is not terribly long, but worth considering. William Black writes, we are in the midst of the blame game about the sequester. I wrote last year about the fact that President Obama had twice blocked Republican efforts to remove the sequester. President Obama went so far as to issue a veto threat to block the second effort. I found contemporaneous reportage on the president's efforts to preserve the sequester, and the articles were not critical of those efforts. I found no contemporaneous rebuttal by the administration of these reports. In fairness, the Republicans did start it by threatening to cause the U.S. to default on its debts in 2011. Their actions were grotesquely irresponsible and anti-American. It is also true that the Republicans often supported the sequester. The point I was making was not who should be blamed for the insanity of the sequester. The answer was always both political parties. I raised the president's efforts to save the sequester because they revealed his real preferences. Those of us who teach economics explain to our students that what people say about their preference is not as reliable as how they act. Their actions reveal their true preference. President Obama has always known that the sequester is terrible public policy. He has blasted it as a manufactured crisis. The administration has stated publicly the three reasons this is so. First, the sequester represents self-destructive austerity. Indeed, it would be the fourth act of self-destructive austerity. The August 2011 budget deal already sharply limited spending, and the January 2013 fiscal cliff deal raised taxes on the wealthiest Americans and restored the full payroll tax. The cumulative effect of these three forms of austerity has already strangled the modest recovery, adding the sequester, particularly given the Eurozone's austerity-induced recession, could tip us into a gratuitous recession. Second, the sequester is a particularly stupid way to inflict austerity on a nation, although I will opine that I can't think of a particularly intelligent way of doing it, because austerity is a failure, straight up a failure. It just is. There's nowhere on this little blue-green marble hurtling through the universe that you can point to and say, oh, look, austerity worked there. It's kind of like trickle-down economics. It's kind of like what, behaving almost like a journalist this weekend, David M.C. Rove Gregory, actually said to John Boehner, there is no evidence to suggest that cutting taxes grows the economy. To which Boehner said,
The sons of evidence. Everybody loves the stork.
No, he said that maybe it was mountains of
mountains of evidence.
Mountains. And the sequester cuts are, in fact, you know, very real. But you'd never know it to hear it from John Boner. No, not at all. No, John Boner says that the tax discussion is over and that we can go F ourselves. Well, he didn't say that, but you know, close enough for government work. Like I said, we got a lot of more in here. But anyway, back for just a minute to Mr. Black's article. He says that the sequester is a particularly stupid way to inflict austerity on a nation. It's a bad combination of across-the-board cuts, but with many exemptions that lead to the cuts concentrating heavily in many vital programs that are already badly underfunded. Third, conservatives purport to believe in what Paul Krugman derisively calls the confidence fairy. They assert that uncertainty explains our inadequate demand. You would think that they were devotees of Heisenberg or something. The absurd self-destructive austerity deals induced or threatened by the sequester have caused recurrent crises and maximized uncertainty. They also show that the U.S. is not ready for prime time. When he acted to save the sequester, Obama proved that he preferred the sequester to the alternative. When the alternative threatened by the Republicans was causing a default on the U.S. debt by refusing to increase the debt limit, one could understand Obama's preference, though even there I would have called the Republican bluff. Well, I will merely point out that it is easy to espouse burn, baby, burn as an operational philosophy if one is quite certain that one's paycheck is going to continue to arrive every couple of weeks at your, you know, chair in academe. Not so much, however, when the actions of a president can very easily cause the entire governmental workforce structure to fall apart. Just say it. The Republicans, however, had extended the debt limit in both of the cases that President Obama acted to save the sequester in 2011. Similarly, President Obama has revealed his real preferences in the current blame game by not calling for a clean bill eliminating the sequester. Can we take just a moment here? This is not, nor will it ever be, nor has it ever been, the Barack Obama fan club. I'm of the opinion that the man is no liberal. He is far from progressive. He is deeply indebted to and solicitous of, to the point of fawning, Wall Street. But one must, if one is going to exist in reality land, and I'm fond of reality land, really. I don't like a world where miracles happen, because for every positive miracle, there are probably a half a dozen or a dozen of the negative sort. The goddess of irony is, irony. It's her province. And she works it. But here in reality land, we have to understand that if Barack Obama proposed a law proclaiming that kittens wandering in the middle of a busy highway, that kittens should be prevented from wandering into the middle of a busy highway. Okay, now let's make it easier for the Republicans. If Barack Obama suggested that the Congress might want to pass a law that baby humans should not be allowed to crawl into busy intersections, for all of their vaunted devotion to the culture of life and snowflake babies. The Republicans would declare the Obama No Crawling in Intersections Act to be a matter of starkest Kenyan Muslim socialist anti-colonialist treachery. And you and I both know that to be true. So when I hear people say, but he didn't, why hasn't the Senate passed a budget? See, this is one of those moments when we need Dr. Bill, because we understand that we would then understand that the Constitution sets up that the House of Representatives is in control of what are commonly referred to as the purse strings. And the Senate can do that or pound sand or take up crochet. But the House has the purse strings. The House is supposed to start revenue bills within its jurisdiction, within the House. So there's a little bit of disingenuity at work here. Mr. Black continues, or Dr. Black continues, it is striking that as far as I know, one, neither Obama nor any administration official has called for the elimination of the sequester, and two, we have a fairly silly blame game about how the sequester was created without discussing the implications of Obama's continuing failure to call for the elimination of the sequester despite his knowledge that it is highly self-destructive. I don't know if that's a true statement. I know that for the last 2 weeks, the Republicans have been hollering, it's all Obama's fault. That does not constitute the blame game, and I tend to discount people who use that sickening phrase that goes back to the dark, miserable 8 years that we spent with dim leader in the White House. Mr. President, do you feel that you were provided bad intelligence that led you to attack the people of Iraq?
Well, this should be a bad time to get into the blame game.
That's where that came from. So it is almost as though some people feel the need to perpetuate the childish stupidities of those 8 years. Now that he is 5 years gone from office.
You miss me yet?
So, I don't know. Dr. Black concludes saying the only logical inference, and we shall see if that is the case, that can be drawn is that Obama remains committed to inflicting the grand bargain, really the grand betrayal, on the nation in his quest for a legacy, and continues to believe that the sequester provides him the essential leverage he feels he needs to coerce Senate progressives to adopt austerity, make deep cuts in vital social programs, and to begin to unravel the safety net. Now, this is described as the only logical inference. And if it is the only logical inference, it is also true that when the House of Representatives is run by people who have thrown logic, common sense, reason, compassion, science itself, biology, physiology, zoology, and everything perhaps except phrenology out the damn window, then to talk about logical inferences and onlys is, again, to ignore
to stand in front of the bars of the monkey house with the poo dripping off your face and think that you're not getting poo flung at you. That is the House of Representatives. And this is a government that has been reduced to profound dysfunction, not by some refusal of Barack Obama, but by the refusal of the House of Representatives to do its work. Now, Sandra just sent me along a story from CNBC via, well, from Reuters via CNBC. President Barack Obama raised anew the issue of cutting entitlements such as Medicare and Social Security as a way out of damaging budget cuts, a White House official said on Sunday, as both sides in Washington tried to limit a fiscal crisis that may soon hit millions of Americans. He's reaching out to Democrats who understand we have to make serious progress on long-term entitlement reform, and Republicans who realize that if we had that type of entitlement reform, they'd be willing to have tax reform that raises revenues to lower the deficit. That, according to Gene Sperling, lately of the TIFF with that genius member of the for-profit media, Bob Woodward. And sooner or later, we're going to find out if this is gamesmanship or if this really is his desire. And frankly, God help him if it really is his desire. Because what Eisenhower said about any political party touching Social Security ceasing to be a national party within a generation has not necessarily come to pass with regard to the Republicans. But it's also a case of I-O-K-I-Y-A-R. It's okay if you're a Republican. If that is indeed what Barack Obama does, then the Democratic Party will cease to be a national party in less than a generation. And it will at least be interesting to see what rises in its place. That's the problem. We don't know what is gamesmanship and what is his real desire. Except, again, I go back to say what I heard aboard that boat 2 years ago when it was reported that he once said his fondest desire was entitlement reform. Which, if true, and if it ever comes to pass, will amount to a brutalizing of the working class of this country in ways that have not been imagined since, Jesus, the 1880s, the 1890s, the days of the Supreme Court's love affair with privity of contract. But Mr. Black does make, Dr. Black does make a valid observation. He says Obama's newest budget offer includes cuts to the safety net and provides that two-thirds of the austerity inflicted would consist of spending cuts instead of tax increases. When that package is one's starting position, the end result of any deal will be far worse. Then he finishes by saying, in any event, there is a clear answer to how to help our nation. Both parties should agree tomorrow to do a clean deal eliminating the sequester without any conditions. By doing so, Obama would demonstrate that he had no desire to inflict the grand betrayal. And the other side of that equation, which Black does not note, is the Republicans would then prove that they are not irredeemably insane. It is understood inside Republican circles that there will be a full-on riot. If Boehner cracks and allows additional taxation. And Boehner likes his power and very much likes his Merlot. And Sandra's right. She says it's the constant fallacious argument that raising taxes and closing loopholes is equivalent to cutting the safety net. Well, I'll believe that the Republicans want to close loopholes when they do it. You know, one of the few tax breaks remaining for working people is the mortgage reduction. Do you remember that there used to be a time when you could deduct credit card interest? The interest on your car note? That time really existed in America. When the monies that you paid out for the privilege of doing business with a bank so that you could have a car that would take you to work was recognized as the federal government as money that really didn't wind up being income to you. Because while it was income, it was mandatory outgo as well. Texas Betsy making a good point. She says, austerity worked in my little household for a few years, but we're a pretty small economy. Right, well, the right wing doesn't understand that nuance. No, they don't do nuance. And household budgets, as our buddy Benedict in the chat room, is he in there? Yep. Well, we'll explain. Household budgets are not the same thing as governmental budgets, especially when one gets to print one's own money. Benedict observing in the chat room right now. If you've never been there, by the way, it's fun. It's a fun little place to inhabit. He says, with Obama, it's always someone else's fault. And I think with all presidents, it's always someone else's fault. And he's fortunate, one way or the other, whichever way this case comes down, that he has a Republican Party that is willing to go to the mattresses over granny starving. Because they want them some granny starving. The question is how badly Barack Obama wants it too. And see, that's the mess that we find ourselves in. How do you square these things up? On Sunday, the man who, well, I guess he had his couple of months of pouting, but now he's been coaxed out of his spider hole by the Radio Rwanda. Chris Wallace sat down with Bishop Willard Romney, who apparently still hasn't figured out anything.
We did very well with the majority population, but not with minority populations. And that was a failing. That was a real mistake.
Why do you think that was?
Well, I think the Obamacare attractiveness and feature was something we underestimated, particularly among lower incomes, and just didn't do as good a job at connecting with that audience as we should have.
Notice how he talks about us. We're not lower income people. We're just lower incomes. And Obamacare was just so attractive that he couldn't overcome it. It was his kryptonite, I guess. We did very well with the majority population. See, he can't quite bring himself to say, we were good with the white folks. but people of darker skin just don't trust Republicans. And again, within this whole discussion, I think we have to come back to that. What would the sequester, would there be a sequester if we were talking about President Romney? No, hell no! There wouldn't be a sequester. Because he would have cajoled and begged and pleaded and whined until he got a nice house-crafted, granny-starving Republican budget. And we wouldn't have any questions about whether or not someone was merely coming to the table willing to cut so-called entitlements, a word which I despise, as a bargaining chip or as a strategic chess item. No, he really wanted to do it, and there was no damn question about it. But he's not president because he couldn't connect with the lower incomes, who are merely incomes and not actual functioning human beings. Sweet Jesus. But it is Moran Monday, and we can't spend all our time camped out in sequester land. We've got to look at some other things. Like, for instance, before we leave sequester, how about this? The folks at Think Progress came up with a list of what they call the 32 dumbest and most devastating sequester cuts. By all means, let's examine them. $20 million cut from the maternal, infant, and early childhood home visiting programs. $10 million cut from the World Trade Center Health Program Fund. Oh, that's nice. $168 million cut from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. $75 million cut from the Aging and Disability Services Programs. And again, we find ourselves with a just dumbstruck by the idea that a president could look at these things and think that is there a consensus on this that Barack Obama is actually sitting out there in the White House saying, gee, I can't wait to cut $170 million from low-income home energy assistance. I like it when people are cold in the dark. Because I'll be straight up about this. Not that I'm not always. I can't wrap my mind around that. I mean, I could easily wrap my mind around it if it was Willard Romney. But it is utterly foreign to me to be a Democrat and have a Democratic president. But then again, you know, we had Bill Clinton. And, well, thanks for that welfare reform, Bill. So I'm not serving as an advocate here. Or really much of a partisan. $928 million cut from the Federal Emergency Management Agency's disaster relief funds. That'll work out well as tornado season kicks in. $6 million cut from emergency food and shelter. $70 million from agricultural disaster relief at the USDA. $61 million from the Hazardous Substances Superfund at EPA. $125 million from the Wildland Fire Management Service. $53 million cut from salaries and expenses at Food Safety and Inspection. Salaries and expenses
What's a little E. coli among friends? And yes, Obamacare, which Willard Romney could not surmount, gets its own cuts. 13 million gets cut out of the consumer-operated and oriented plan program, the co-ops. 57 million gets cut from the healthcare fraud and abuse control unit. 51 million gets cut from the prevention and public health fund. 27 million gets cut from the state grants and demonstrations project. 44 million get cut from the Affordable Insurance Exchange grants program. It goes on and on and on. 86 million cut from student financial assistance. Now, if in fact you want to impose some sort of brutal austerity via the back door on the American people, why would you ballyhoo on one hand getting a new student loan banking regulation law in your first term and then turn around and gut student financial assistance in your second? 71 million gets cut from the administration at the Office of Federal Student Aid. 184 million gets cut from rehabilitation services and disability research. 633 million gets cut from the Department of Education special education programs. Anybody want to holler Benghazi? I mean, the Republic, John McCain has now gone from, "You kids get off my lawn," to, "You kids get off my lawn, Benghazi." He's got precious Lindsey Graham there. Yeah, Benghazi, damn it. 79 million has been cut, will be cut from embassy security, construction, and maintenance. Benghazi! And this is reassuring. 604 million get cut from the National Nuclear Security Administration. $232 million gets cut from the Federal Aviation Administration. Now, regardless of which way you prefer to view this, one of two things has to be true. The Republican Party will tell you that this was all wasted money anyway. And that once we find out that everything is okay without it, we'll find out that that money was just wasted. The other side of it, is that these really are necessary services. That $394 million really is needed in the defense environmental cleanup line item. One thing is true. Barack Obama runs away from bad press. And so now that the Washington Post has labeled him a Pinocchio. Didn't have any Pinocchios for Boner, though. And, well, maybe he gets the Merlocchio. He does run away from bad press. So, having had Arne Duncan and a few of his other officials lambasted by the Post for talking about real-world impacts of the sequester, I have a feeling we're not going to be seeing any more of that, which will make it even harder than it already was to quantify this sort of piecemeal approach to austerity. And can't you hear it now? Let's say that there is something that goes wrong between midnight and 6 over one of these smaller airports, and there's no air traffic control. Something bad happens. Well, the minute any of us says, it's that austerity thing, it's that sequester, what are we going to hear?
Oh, now this is no time to be playing the blame game.
The drunk is not nearly a speaker as you think he is. We both know that, don't we? So there we are. First hour gone. Filibuster over. We will take a break. Thank you so very much for pushing us over the top with Shirley's challenge this evening. It is heartening and inspiring. This is Conversation Radio on the Horn. We can talk for a little bit after the break. The number, 304-658-3333, and we will return post-haste. I'm Bob Kincaid.
So it's been a good year, finally coming back around. We all walk out from the ledge, nobody buried us in the ground. Nobody made a ton of money, we all lost a little spark. But we can't give up now, cause we haven't made our mark. The devil's in the details, we can pick it apart. We got credit cards and busted cars and freight train hard.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Like that song. Wandering around over on Bandcamp when I found that. A little bit of Muscle Shoals music. That's Brown Lawler. Freight Train Heart. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. It is about 6 minutes past the hour. And we can, like I said, I'm going to be rerunning, or not rerunning, I've never run it here before. I'm going to be running Dr. Bill's remarks on American exceptionalism as a way of sort of introducing you to what you can expect from him when we begin his show either tomorrow or as soon as we get the technical kinks worked out. I think that'll probably happen tomorrow. But at any rate, I'll start running that about the bottom of the hour. But between now and then, a little bit of conversation for this Moran Monday. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob. How you doing?
I'm well, Jim. How are you?
Okay. How was your weekend?
Pretty good. Stayed busy, mostly.
I'm sure you did. You're going to run the rest of the program after the midpoint with Dr. O'Brien?
Yeah, Dr. Bill's American Exceptionalism lecture.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I think that people have seen enough of that without having to listen to that. That's for sure.
Well, that means that you need to listen to it too, Jim, because it is a complete deconstruction of what the right wing portrays as American exceptionalism. It doesn't mean what they think it means.
I see. Question quickly. You know, with economic austerity coming with the sequestration. And a lot of people think that just because it didn't happen Friday, that it's just not going to happen, they're not going to notice it. Well, I guess people didn't notice initially when the Titanic hit that iceberg.
Well, I think that's very true, and that is an apt analogy, Jim.
And, I mean, it took an hour or two before people realized exactly how serious the damage was and what it can do. But my question to you is if, excuse me, how can we afford to expend all this money with Syria and outlays with Syria and Egypt and things of that nature when we need programs being bolstered and not cut here at home?
Well, if I understand the way the sequester works, it's a meat axe job. So if we were going to give X amount of money to Egypt, we're going to give X minus however much the sequester is. Because this is not, you know, this is not any sort of measured approach. This is meat axe austerity.
But the money's still going to be given to these nations, regardless, and I don't know when they will receive the money.
Right.
But it's going to be taken away from programs that are needed here at home.
Well, not that. Indirectly, I suppose, yes, but directly, no.
I don't understand that.
Well, everything, you know, it's the government. Every there's a line item for everything in the budget.
I know that very well.
So, consequently, if you've got a line item called aid to Egypt, it's going to be reduced. But there's still a budget line item there. It's not getting zeroed out. Whereas, we've got millions being cut from food aid, you know, Meals on Wheels, food aid for seniors. We've got, obviously, millions being cut for, what all was in that list? Millions being cut for environmental environmental cleanup in the Pentagon's budget. So you can't necessarily say if I understand correctly, they can't just sit there and rework the budget and say we're gonna make sure that the seniors get fed by taking the money that we were going to send to Syria or Egypt.
and feed the seniors with that. Because they're still operating under continuing resolutions related to, you know, the last budget that the Congress passed.
Well, speaking of lining things out, when's the last time they've come up with a balanced budget at the end of the fiscal year, or with any type of not balanced budget, but with any type of plan of financial outlay without having to do a continuing resolution?
5 years since the last actual budget.
Well, then that proves exactly how.
And the end of the Clinton era, for the last time that we had a surplus instead of a deficit. That was what enabled Richard B. Dick Big Time Cheney to say things like, deficits don't matter.
Well, obviously they do. And obviously that's the
element. Well, actually, he was kind of, I hate to say this about Dick Cheney, Jim, but he was kind of right for the wrong reasons. When you are in the middle of an economic crisis, such as the Great Recession brought on, deficits don't matter. You've got to get the country moving. You've got to get the country working. You've got to get the economy going. And most Keynesian economists, or most economists, recognize the validity of Keynesian thought and agree that you deficit spend when you're in a hole like that, because we've got history to point to as an explanation for why. You know, FDR had this country on the road to recovery, and what was it, 1936, 1937, when Henry Morgenthau got the deficit fan, Todd, we tightened our belts and threw ourselves back into the Depression again.
Well, there were other political things behind Morgenthau besides that.
Well, but the wealth always worries about deficits.
Well, I think they were more worried about, if I'm not mistaken, about Roosevelt's attempt to pack the Supreme Court. But here again, they can line these items out. They can say, look, we don't have the money to send to you. We cannot take care of our own. That's the point of this call to you tonight.
Do you think that's going to happen, Jim?
No, but it could happen if people had need sense and tried to realize that if you don't have it, you can't give it. And if you do have it, you can't give it to people who don't deserve it. Because I think our own people deserve it more than anybody else.
Well, you think that, and I think that, but there is a Republican majority in the House of Representatives that is devoted to the idea of granny starving.
Bob, how much economic experience do these idiots have in the House of Representatives?
Well, John will tell you anytime you ask him all about how he understands economics because he grew up in a bar.
You know, I wish that fool would absolutely come into the House and get on the air on C-SPAN and on the networks talking the way you mimic him supposedly talking. And trouble is, he doesn't talk like that.
There are a few clips of him out there loaded.
Well, it's not that noticeable. It's just basically him. He has very few things to say and moves on, and he's totally intransigent about everything. And you know, what I think is this sequester thing. Why in the hell did the president ever agree to that thing?
Well, if you believe Dr. Black there, he not only believed in it, he wanted it as a means of enforcing his theory of entitlement reform. That the New Deal has outlived its viability, and that we've got to do something different. That's a theory that's very much in vogue among the people who know which fork to use with the shrimp, Jim. That America is going to hell because we're not letting enough of our old people starve to death.
Well, I don't agree with that, and I don't think that it's a very valid way of taking care of your own people in this country.
Well, Jim, I agree with you, but again, there is a fundamental philosophical disconnect here. the Republican Party does not believe that it is the job of government to take care of its weakest, its poorest, its sickest, or its eldest.
Well, I don't think it's the opinion of either party, Bob.
No, there are still some Democrats left who are staunch defenders of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food aid, nutrition assistance, Head Start, you know, things that benefit the working class. They're still there, and there's actually a quite decent number of them. But they are certainly outnumbered to a significant degree, especially in the House, by the granny starvers. And it appears that the granny starvers are going to get their way.
And then, of course, on March 27th, they're going to have to refund the government or keep it going. I just wonder what type of deals they've cut in order, you know, unless we have our way, we're going to shut the government down and bring it all to a halt.
Well, that remains to be seen on what? March 27th.
That's right.
The Onion recently, you know, the satire site, recently had a headline about how the Republicans plan to shut the government down on March 27th, April 12th, April 27th, and every 2 weeks thereafter. This is, for the most part, a decided, determined, and dedicated effort on the part of the Republican Party, regardless of what one thinks about Barack Obama's particular motives. On their part, it is a decided effort to dismantle government as we know it in the United States, period.
Okay.
And that's I don't know about you, Jim, but I find that frightening. I find it unpatriotic, un-American. And it makes me tremble for my grandchildren.
For your grandchildren? I think it's going to come a lot sooner than that.
Well, but they are the ones who will be left to deal with the real mess when they're adults, that generation.
Well, that was my question. You know, number one, how can we continue to outlay money to peoples overseas when we can't take care of our own people here? And maybe I mean terribly naive, but that's not the government that I used to work for. And I hate to see these changes coming, but, you know, these people are, number one, I don't think they really have sense enough or compassion enough and are far-sighted enough to realize exactly what is going to happen here. You know, as long as the Dow remains above 14,000, whatever it is today, it was just going on and on, and as long as these things continue in the minds of the well-to-do, we've got a lot of people who really don't care.
Right. We don't have a crisis. And again, I think you've just identified it, Jim. We do not have a crisis in this country as long as Wall Street says there's no crisis. And what all this is predicated on, from the austerity to the granny starving, is the Wall Street pronouncement that it is useless eaters who represent the real threat to our economy, not the guys standing at the Wall Street roulette wheel saying red, no, black, red. You see what I'm saying?
I do.
Wall Street and the 1% are defining our public good. They're defining the health of our body politic, and they are going to define it right into the dirt. But of course, as is referenced somewhere in the New Testament, when that day comes that the Dow crashes again, as a result not of government overregulation, but as a result instead of Wall Street's own avarice, they will be the first ones to cry, Lord, Lord.
I know. And last sentence here. How many years ago did I tell you who ran this country besides Main Street? Main Street has no real effect. It's Wall Street and K Street.
Sure it is.
All right, take care.
See you, Jim. Bye now. Email coming in, that's our buddy Jim. email coming in from Sergi in Texas. Good evening to you in your snow-covered region from a city that just had a high temperature of 88 in early March. I mean, seriously. And Sergi's in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. Sergi says, I mean, seriously, I was able to do today's yard work assignment shirtless when I thought I wouldn't get to do so until April. Ain't jacking with the planet's climate fun? Anyway, I digress. Your talk about McCain and Benghazi got me thinking. Remember back in 2008 when someone, I forget who, said that Rudy Giuliani's campaign stop structured his sentences with a noun, a verb, and 9/11? Well, that's how McCain is today. A noun, a verb, and Benghazi! Good grief, says Sergi. History does, indeed, repeat itself. And back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I noticed on your website you had a Monopoly game on there, which I thought was apropos to my call.
Okay, how about a first name?
I'm sorry. I'm Jeff, and I'm right now in Florida. We travel a bit, but it's nice and warm here. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that both sides, we're this whole world is caught up in a game to balance a budget that is fictitious. People we're borrowing money from is the IMF and the World Bank, or quasi people. And they're not giving us goods and services. They're giving us a piece of paper that legally we have to pay back with interest. I mean, what we're paying back is labor, and is our real labor. Why are we with interest? So my point is, why don't we just go ahead and make up our own currency? And some of the currency will go for schools and health care. The more education we have, the more, anyone can go for education, and the more education you have, the more educators you have. The more educators you have, the more doctors you have, the more, and so on and so forth. And for this, we only need a 20 or 30-hour work week. And it's anything more than that, that puts everybody back to work. And you can do it on a worldwide basis. And you have a number that what a human being is worth. And then if you make $1 million a day, you've got to put back because you have inherited knowledge. Does that make sense? I just can't understand why we're playing this Monopoly game, and we're all playing by these rules that are fictitious.
I understand some of what you're getting at, Jeff. Obviously, when you say, why don't we print our own currency, well, the United States does print its own currency. That's one of the differences between here and Europe. You know, there's a crisis with the euro because of the inherent instability of some of the countries that bought in to the idea of a common European currency. So, for instance, Greece can't inflate its way out of its debt because it doesn't control the currency anymore.
But basically, the whole world has to buy the U.S. dollar to buy oil. That's why the American dollar is staying strong. And the one who did that was the first Bush, and he sent Kissinger over, and they made an ingenious deal about this. So that's why our currency is the preferred currency of the world.
Well, it's the currency of the bourse. You might remember that part of the background reason for attacking Saddam Hussein was because he announced that he was no longer going to do oil business in dollars.
Exactly right. You're one of the few people who understand that, by the way. But that's great. No, but I'm trying to get a point that if I told you I'm in Florida and the temperature here is 250 degrees, you'd say you're either crazy or lying or both. If you have a basic measurement for what a human being is worth anywhere in the world, just like horsepower, and we say if you work 20 hours a week, the way we're going to change, the only thing we have to do is you keep 20 hours a week, you get 100, whatever the currency is, and for that you get education for you and your child. Again, the more education you have, the more educators you have, the more engineers you have, the more doctors you have, you get basic health care. Then you have basic food, basic shelter, but if you want a gold-plated toilet bowl seat, you'll have to work a little harder. But you let the free market take off after that, but you have a measurement. So no one could say to you that your grandchild or your child is worth 1,000 or 10,000 times less than, let's say, Romney. Only in this crazy society is that to happen. By the way, I am a capitalist, but I believe you have to have a fair shot between capitalism and socialism. And without a measurement, you can't go onto the Occupy group. It's unfair. Well, what's unfair? not the way this system's set up, but if we have a measurement, a basic minimum measurement, which we worked on, a basic measurement, a minimum measurement for what a human being is worth, then you can go from the minimum to a higher number.
Well, in essence, you were talking, at least in part, about the concept of a living wage. And whether you realize it or not, Jeff, you're also tapping into something that was part of the social and political thinking of the late 19th century. The Wobblies, who were much maligned by the capitalist structure of the late 19th century and early 20th century, were brutally suppressed. They were a labor organization, but their underlying concept was one big union. In other words, that there would be an expression of human worth within wage structures. And that sounds a little bit like where you're headed, but the other part of that also that I think also deserves to be noticed is that, you know, you say I'm a capitalist, but I think, and from there, first of all, let's understand a couple of things. One, capitalism as expressed by Adam Smith is not what is practiced under the rubric of capitalism in the 21st century. If you actually sit down and read Adam Smith,
the treatise of Adam Smith, he had it nailed to the wall until money came into place, and then he said money is like gold, and therefore it'll never rot, it'll never do anything. And then you had the other guy, I forget who came in, and he said, and he put God in there. So with the minute you put those two things together, Smith did great up until a certain point.
We also need to understand that the Wealth of Nations during Smith's lifetime was considered to be one of his lesser works. He was one of the great progressive social thinkers of his age, and yet, oddly enough, we remember him solely for a lesser work that he did about money. The second part, though, about capitalism is this, and this is where you might disagree with me, but that's okay. Capitalism, as it was understood and identified by Smith, is predicated upon a logical fallacy that makes the whole thing collapsive, because capitalism is predicated upon always increasing consumption. And we have learned in the world in which we live that you can't always increase consumption, because you are talking about goods themselves that are essentially finite, especially when you're talking about things like oil.
No, I concur with that 100%. I've been promoting renewable energy only for the fact of the matter that it is locally produced, and it gifts of nature or gifts of God doesn't require payback. So once you build that, you have your multiplier for your labor. I'm agreeing with you 100%. The problem I'm running into is no one's talking about how we get there. The Occupy groups are right on, but they're not giving you a measurement. We need a measurement like horsepower. And the problem with the worldly groups, the union group, they were fine, but no one in the history of mankind ever had a measurement for what human intellect and labor were worth. But the reality is that we can now do that. The technology is here that we can come up with a minimum number. And if we did a 20 or a 30-hour work week, there's enough natural resources to give everybody a fair shot at not slavery any longer. So we can do, if you want to put people back to work, just easily put in a 30-hour work week or a 20-hour work week, and you've got the game beat.
I think there's some truth in what you say. And interestingly enough, you talk about that unit of measurement. It is not specifically on point, Jeff, but it is worth thinking about. For instance, the way that the Germans have accomplished their movement toward what they call their Energiewende, their changeover in their energy structure toward renewables, is a little piece of legislation that is, well, I mean, it's derided in this country by the capitalists, called a feed-in tariff. If you've ever read about that, it is a way of letting people produce their own energy onto the market and establishing a higher value for that energy than that which is produced by the massive corporate interests that have massive resources.
The fellow pushed that through was Schmidt, I think, or Scheer, and I met him at a conference, and I said, "How did you get this to pass?" And he laughed. He said, "It was a mistake." But they tried to get the big guys tried to get through water power, and they pushed it for renewable, and the country just jumped on it. But you know, what I'm saying is that if we had a measurement, which we do, if you want me to email you, I'll email you a simple 7-page site. But we actually looked we took a whole bunch of colleges across the country, and they said it takes 5,000 hours of human labor to produce 1 million BTUs, and we divided those 5,000 into 1 million, and we got 156, and we said if we had a 20-hour work week, and that 20-hour work week would give people 100, whatever the currency is, then that is for 20 hours of labor and intellect. You would get education for you and your child. You would then get more health care because you have now doctors and so on and so forth, and engineers, and then you have basic food and shelter, and then if you want to have a fancy thing, you can work more hours. But if you're making $1 million a minute or an hour, or some people are making $1 million a day comfortably now, you have to put that back because of inherited knowledge. Now, we don't know what that top number should be, but I'm sure a computer whiz could figure this out. Enough people put in a computer program for that. So we can actually get a minimum maximum number. We call that, by the way, a human energy renewable measurement. But you gotta type in the whole thing, www, the harm. Otherwise it comes out lousy. But anyway,
well, shoot me a note and let me read up on that.
I will definitely email you that tonight or tomorrow. Okay, but you have to look at the whole website. You have to type in www.theherm, otherwise it comes out hermaphrodite. So make sure you type the whole thing in, otherwise it comes out lousy. It's not a popular site. And look at the summary. It's only 7 pages. And
okay.
I'll get you an email on that. But meanwhile, we need the problem with all these things. All these economists. There was one economist, I can't remember his name now. He's about 100 years ago. Every human being in the world has to have access, Mises. To a commodity that everybody wants, but they have to have access to it. Now, gold used to be a great commodity because it has specific weight, specific weight, an ounce or a gram or whatever. So you can bank on that, but that currency became a commodity. But now, what does every human being in the world have access to? No matter where they are, they have access to their intellect and their labor. So if we can put a number on that, like horsepower, my God, we got a game. We got a game. And no one could lie to me and say, they can say, well, I'm worth 1 million times more than you. Yes, you are. This particular economy, which is totally a monopoly game. We're all bought in worldwide. We bought into this monopoly game. We have to get out of this monopoly game and start measuring numbers that work, because human beings require numbers. So you know, if I told you it's 200 degrees right now in Florida, you know I'm not telling you the truth. If I told you I'll sell you a 3-horsepower car, you know damn well it's not going to move you forward. The economic system is strictly a belief system, and we need to get some scientific basis into it. Does that make sense?
I do understand. I understand what you're getting at, and I don't know. Well, I'm gonna read what you send me and go and have a look and see if I can sort it out a little bit better for myself. But I understand the nature of the complaint because it's the nature of a similar complaint I have, and that is simply that we cannot consume our way out of a problem that the problems that the planet faces at this point in time.
Right, and I agree with that. But the reality is, I think there's enough. As a matter of fact, there's a group out there called the Venus Project, and they talk about a resource-based economy. And I believe there is enough resources out in this on this planet to give every man, woman, and child a quality of life that you and I have the luxury of talking like we're speaking now. The average person doesn't even have time even to think about what we're talking about.
No, somewhere between a third and a half of the people on this planet do not have access to clean water or some way of managing sewage.
Exactly. I agree. That to me is ridiculous, because there's not a problem with the technology. There's a problem with the distribution of this technology. That's your problem. It's
right, and we have a system right now that relies on those inequities in order to self-perpetuate.
Exactly. That's why we need the measurement to say, you are wrong. You are not worth 1 million times more than
I mean, if we took a million people, if we took a million of the people who are starving on this planet
and insisted that they be able to live a basic subsistence lifestyle, Willard Romney might have to go down to 3 houses.
No, you have to go down to 20 houses. You've got to get rid of it. But that's the point. I have no problem with it. If you think that's going to make you happy, by all means. But it's not making you happy. The next step is you want to be president and control the world. You want to hoard more and more and more. Hoarding is a sickness, and it's a sickness. Poor or rich, it's still a sickness. But we need to get. My point is, if we had a measurement to show. Something like horsepower for human beings, that we can show a minimum maximum, and then we have to do a computer model that says, okay, you're making $5.5 million a day, maybe you've got to put 94% of that back, you're still going to be a very, very wealthy human being. But the point is, at least you're putting it back to the system, and we have to get off of this monetary system that we have now, and I love when I saw the monopoly set on your website, I knew you were the right guy.
Well, bless your heart. Thank you very much. I always appreciate a first-time call, and I hope we'll hear from you again.
Thank you very much. Have a very good night.
Thanks. Take care, Jeff. Bye now. From Florida, that is Jeff. And as I noted, by way of introduction, to those of you who are not familiar with him, I am going to run some remarks from last summer by Dr. Bill O'Brien. They should take up the remainder of the program. We hope to have Dr. Bill on the air, and this will not be his first time by any stretch of the imagination. This will be a renewal of what he was doing. And I hope you will find this discussion as meaningful as do I. Because when we take something that the right wing has beaten on mercilessly, like American exceptionalism, and turned it into a tawdry and almost pornographic thing, a cheap excuse for exploitation and rampant avarice, and for, you know, enforcing misery upon those millions of people I mentioned a minute ago, so that one man can have 50 houses or some such stupidity as that, then you know we have a problem, and you know that we have forgotten the essence of the argument. So without further ado, Dr. Bill O'Brien on American exceptionalism. Dr. Bill will be live, hopefully tomorrow, at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, and I hope you will get enough of a taste for his way of thinking to join in at that time, and if you like it, and I suspect you will, to spread the word. Dr. Bill O'Brien, American Exceptionalism, on the Horn.
Some people believe that America is the greatest nation in the history of the world because we're the only nation committed to the idea of trying to help everybody else in the world live a standard of living that comes close to ours. On the other end of the spectrum are those people that believe that the United States of America is probably one of the more exploitative nations in the history of the world because under the guise of trying to help other people, we have created models of ourselves and integrated people into a system which we dominate, we control, and we extract most of the wealth from. And so what you end up with is some of the greatest advocates or patriots of America on the one hand and some of America's greatest critics on the other. And so this is absolutely a vital issue, it seems to me, a critical issue. And there's absolutely no question that the whole idea of American exceptionalism is a theme that goes all the way through American history, and I'll try to explain that. There's no question about something else, and it is the idea that most people who subscribe to some form, some facet of American exceptionalism usually go back into the colonial period to find the origins of it. And specifically, more than any place else, they go back to the 1630 sermon delivered by John Winthrop, the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, on the Arbella, as the Puritans are on the high seas coming to settle Boston in 1630. And in that sermon, John Winthrop is telling the people what we are doing, why we are going into the New World, what our goal is, what our mission is. And most people see the origins, the foundation of American exceptionalism in that speech. So that's the speech that I have up here this evening. It's one of the most frequently quoted and cited sources in early American history. And the version that I have up here, obviously Microsoft Word identifies all the misspellings, so all of those red words are misspelled. But basically what I would tell you is when you look at this, it almost looks like a foreign language. But if you sound out the words, they are the same words. They are the same as if we spelled them correctly today. There are E's where we've dropped off the E's and those kinds of things. But I would suggest to you that what I thought we might do this evening is look at this speech and look at it in two ways. Look at it for content, but also look at it as, excuse me, as the origin or the foundations of the idea of American exceptionalism. And then when we finish the speech, what we can do is look at how this speech has pretty much informed much of American history throughout the period. And the only thing I would, the idea that America is a special nation, is an exceptional nation, the idea, the word exceptionalism, is, you know, runs all the way through American history. Most people believed it, although different people have different views as to what makes us that special. Some people think that America is specially chosen by God to basically reform the world. The idea being that God's ideal community is reflected in the United States of America, and America's mission to the people of the world is to instigate or initiate the reformation of the world in our own image. So in other words, we create ourselves worldwide. So if you accept that, if that makes sense to you, if you believe, many people believe it's in Scripture. Many people believe that because so many of the original settlers came over here with, you know, with some sort of a religious mission or religious goal, the assumption is that the Almighty must have been behind this. And then if you go back to Bob Bliss's talk the other day, on Monday, I think it was Monday night, when he went through the rights that America, that, you know, that Englishmen didn't have in 1600, and you think about the rights that he identified, we are the only nation in the history of the world that was committed to bringing about the whole idea of human rights. Theoretically, the only nation in the world whose number one priority is a commitment to the benefits and the values of the people who live in it. And I am one, personally, who believes that that does make us somewhat exceptional. And I'm not going to get into whether it's a divine mission, whether the Almighty has inspired it, or whatever. But many people believe that. Many people believe that we have this mission of reform. The major difference is that there's two ways to reform the world. One way is watch what I do and do what I do and live the way I do. In other words, remodel the world by your example. Set up the ideal society. This is what the Puritans believe. Set up the ideal society, and when man sees the way that God really intended his chosen people to live, then the rest of the world will reform itself in our image. That is a legitimate, it seems to me, a very legitimate goal for a people to have. We believe that our goal is to work as hard as we can to create the ideal society with the ideal standard of living for as many people as we possibly can. And if we can make it work, then other people will see how it works and they'll join us. And we will literally be responsible for the reformation of the whole world and the improvement of the standard of living of all the people in it. That's a pretty worthy goal. There are some people that take that goal and they take it to the next step. And the next step is, this is our mission. Unfortunately, there are so many people in the world that are so stupid that they don't know what's good for them. So therefore, since we have a divine mission to reform the world, that gives us the right to reform people even if they don't want to be reformed. In other words, we can basically jam it down their throats and justify it by the idea that we have a mission, and the people who object to it or who stand up and try to fight us or object to us are too stupid to know what's best for them. So in a sense, we know what's best for the world better than the people in it do. And so that's getting us into a lot of trouble. It creates arrogance. The whole concept, the old idea of the ugly American traveling in other countries, and they tend to be arrogant and look down on other people and other cultures and other other societies and other peoples. And I'm trying to think of some of the old movies that would emphasize the ugly American idea, where people throughout the world hate, get to hate Americans because they think we're all arrogant. All we do is throw money around and wear jewelry and all of this stuff. And so that's created a lot of problems for us. There's no question that just studying what we do and how we behave in the world is a tremendous body of literature, and students love it because you can get into specific examples of it. And we will. Most people cite the foundation of this in John Winthrop's speech. So I thought that, it's not that long a speech, but there's no punctuation. The punctuation's not that good. The first sentence is about 34 lines long. So there's a few extra, you've got to kind of provide a few extra comments. So let's look at it. John Winthrop says, "Now the only way to avoid this shipwreck and to provide for our posterity, provide for those who will follow us, is to follow the counsel of Micah, to do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with our God. For this end, we must be knit together in this work as one man. We must entertain each other in brotherly affection. We must be willing to abridge ourselves of our superfluities for the supply of others' necessities. We must uphold a familiar commerce together in all meekness, gentleness, patience, and liberality. We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes our commission and community in the work, our community as members of the same body. So shall we keep the unity." So shall we keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. The Lord will be our God and delight to dwell among us as his own people, and will command a blessing upon us in all our ways." Stop there for a second. So as you read that, you begin to get a feeling as to what he's saying. And what he's basically saying is, we are on a mission. God is basically designing our mission as we sail into the new world. What is it we are doing? We are on a mission from God. And in order to be successful, we must be a perfect, and the word that I'm going to emphasize here, a perfect community. We must treat each other as we would be treated ourselves. We are knit together in God's work, which is to create the ideal community. And that means we function as one man. We entertain each other in brotherly affection. We abridge ourselves of our superfluities for the supply of others' necessities. In other words, we put the needs of others ahead of the things we want. We're always sensitive to the needs of others ahead of ourselves. We uphold a familiar commerce together in meekness, gentleness, patience, and liberality. We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own conditions, rejoice together, mourn together, suffer together, labor together, always having before our eyes the community, the mission, the commission we have from God. And so ultimately, one of the things that you've got to take from this is the idea that we have a big job to do. This is not about us. This is about the ideal way of standard of living, a way of living as sketched out in Scripture by God. And He has chosen us to basically do this. There's the idea of American exceptionalism. Now keep in mind, this is 1630. It's 146 years later that the Declaration of Independence is approved. So he has no idea about self-evident truths and all the people being created equal. He has no idea about Jefferson or anything else. You know, and ultimately this is a small group of people who are on their way to the new world to set up God's kingdom. One of the best books on this that you might want to read is the title. It says it all. It's by Perry Miller, who is an English scholar and philosopher, literature scholar and philosopher at Harvard many years ago. The title of his book is Errand into the Wilderness. And if you think about that title, that says, that's what he's saying. That we are on an errand. And in order to pull it off, we must go into the wilderness. The implication is there's nobody there. You know, Native Americans don't count. I mean, you know, there's nobody there. So ultimately, the only way we can do this is to leave the evils and the sins of the old world and come over and start all over again and do it right. That's the rationalization for leaving England. You know, a lot of people will say, these people just ran away. If they were really reformers, if they really wanted to do God's work, they would have stayed in England and they would have basically tried to reform the Church of England. And they would have, you know, they would have become reformers. And so by running away into the new world, that suggests that they may have had their own self-interest ahead of their mission. But Winthrop is trying to say, we have a mission from God to set up the ideal community, and the only way we can do it is to come to the new world and build it from the beginning. And so basically, that's the idea of mission. There's the whole idea of American exceptionalism right there. The other thing that I will emphasize, and I already have a little bit, is the emphasis on the idea of community. What John Winthrop is telling these people is none of us are as important as all of us. That if we are to be successful in this, it's not because some of us do well, it's because all of us do well. If God gave us a mission, He didn't give it to a few of us. He didn't give it just to the rich people. He gave it to everybody. The implication is that the community has the covenant, not the people in it. Now, The reason I'm emphasizing this is because most of us are familiar. I'm not going to get into whether, you know, some people are this branch of Christianity or that branch of Christianity, whether they're Christians at all. I'm not going to get into that. But even if you aren't, you know enough about, you've come into contact with enough people who are Christian to know that the major emphasis in Christianity from the Reformation on is primarily the relationship between the individual soul and God. The idea being that if I'm saved, that's my number one priority, is to be saved, not to save you. That's your job. So the emphasis is on individualism in Christianity. The reason I'm emphasizing the idea of community is because this emphasis on the individual soul, on my relationship with God, on establishing a personal relationship with my Lord and Savior, with the idea that if I do what I'm supposed to be told, I know that I'm saved. God tells me I'm saved, etc., etc., etc. And then and basically tells me to go out and spread the word. And I come to you and I said, are you saved? Would you like to be saved? Let me tell you how beautiful it is to be saved, you know, etc., etc. I won't go into that. But the point is that in this speech with these people, with this particular community, God is entering into the covenant with everybody. Not just the leaders, not just some. What that means is, if these people follow God's plan, do God's will, the Lord will be our God and delight to dwell among us as His own people, and will command a blessing upon us in all our ways, so that we shall see much more of His wisdom, power, goodness, and truth than formerly we have been acquainted with. We shall find that the God of Israel is among us. When 10 of us shall be able to resist 1,000 of our enemies, when He shall make us a praise and glory, that men shall say of succeeding plantations, the Lord make it like that of New England. In other words, we will be the model. We will be the example. God will be living among us. What that means is we will prosper. Obviously, if we do, there's a very subtle change here. I'm shifting 180 degrees. If we believe that by following God's plan and everybody adhering to it, we will prosper because God will be dwelling among us, then logically, it makes perfect sense that if we're doing good, if the Dow Jones is up, if people are making money, if people are getting jobs, if people are having healthy children, if children are obedient to their parents, if there's a decline in alcoholism, if there's a decline in people having affairs out of wedlock, if children are being obedient to their parents rather than being disobedient, in other words, if you can look around and you see good things happening, then you can logically conclude that we must be doing what God wants us to do. The implication is, it's common sense to take the next step and conclude, God obviously sends signs. God lets us know if what we're doing is what He wants us to do. And we will prosper. So there's an inclination, a temptation here, to say to yourself as an individual, if I'm making money, that must indicate that God has found favor with me. Therefore, I'm probably saved. I'm probably going to be one of the so-called elect, is what they they called it, the chosen people, the people to go to heaven. We won't get into that kind of detail. The point I want to make is that the commission, the mission, the covenant is between God and the entire community. All right. So this is the mission. The Lord make it like that of New England, he says. For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. This is what everybody talks about, the city on a hill. We shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us. So that if we shall deal falsely with our God, now comes the other side. If we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword through the world. We shall open the mouths of enemies to speak evil of the ways of God, and all professors for God's sake. We shall shame the faces of many God's worthy servants, and cause their prayers to be turned into curses upon us, till we be consumed out of the good land whether we are going. So now he gives you the other side of the covenant. If God is going to allow us to prosper for doing what we're supposed to do, then God is going to punish us if we don't. So if God is going to let us know that we're doing what he wants by having low crime rates and healthy families and obedient children and loyal husbands and wives and no fooling around and cheating on spouses and all of this, low crimes, no Indian raids, no droughts, healthy crops, a good quality of life. If we're doing well, that's a sign from God that we're on target. We're adhering to the covenant. We're doing what we're supposed to do. But what Winthrop says is just the opposite of that. But on the other hand, if we don't do what he wants, what God wants, God will let us know that too. The implication is, if he's going to send signals, signs to us that we're doing the right things, then it's logical to conclude that he will send us signals if we are doing the wrong things. Ta-da! Logical conclusion from that is, when you look around and you see bad things happening, you are programmed. I mean, this community is programmed to conclude that everything bad that is happening is a sign from God that we better get our act together. We are veering from the mission. God is telling us that we better get it together. What kinds of things? Indian raids, disease, droughts, floods, an increase in disobedient children, an increase in marriage breakups and divorce, an increase in problems in school where children are disobeying the teacher. Anything that's going wrong, anything that's going bad for the community is a sign that the community better get its act together. So what you see if you read their sermons is that the ministers are constantly engaged in what are called Jeremiads, which are these fire and brimstone sermons screaming at people to get your act together. Stop being a sinner. Women, stop wearing short skirts. Stop doing this. Leave the alcohol alone. Don't do drugs. Raise your children the way you're supposed to be. In other words, everything that you're supposed to do that theoretically is part of the mission is not just your business. You don't even exist. We're not talking about your business. We're talking about the community's business. How you treat your wife is not just your business and her business. It's our business. It's public business. It's the state's business. It's the government's business. How you raise your kids whether your kids are disobedient or not, whether you keep your kids in tow, whether you are kind and treat your wife with respect. Everything you do is public business. Divorce is not a private sacrament between people and their God. Divorce is a public ceremony endorsed by the community. Marriage is a public affair, not a private affair. And the idea is that we better, as leaders of the community, as members of the government, as members of the legislature, as the governor, Winsip saying, we're going to force you to adhere to the law, because if you break the law and we let you do it, we'll all suffer. God will punish us all. So what you see in this community is there's no such thing as your own business, as private rights, free speech, freedom of the press, asking questions. The implication of this society is the truth is there. God has given us the plan in Scripture. The job of the ministers is to explain to the congregation what God wants, and their job is to do it. The emphasis here is on community. God rewards communities, God punishes communities. We as individuals don't exist independent of the community we're in. In other words, we are only what the community provides for us. I'm going to throw something very contemporary. Last 2 weeks ago, President Obama got into trouble when he, in a speech, said, if you are a businessman who has started your own business and doing well, he said, you didn't do that. Everybody did that. We all did that. Government helped. The society built roads and educated your kids and provided a police force and a fire department, provided safety and security and support and infrastructure and education and peace in the streets and all of that so that you could do this. You didn't do it all by yourself. And the Republican attackers, Romney and the other side, has attacked him. Basically, where Obama's coming from is this idea of community. If separate from the community, we are nothing. Okay, let's just finish the thing. I mean, he tells you that this is going to end, and he's telling me the same thing. And to shut up this discourse, he says, in other words, to bring this to an end, with that exhortation of Moses, that faithful servant of the Lord, in his last farewell to Israel, Deuteronomy 30, beloved, there is now set before us life and good, death and evil, in that we are commanded this day to love the Lord our God and to love one another, to walk in his ways and to keep his commandments and his ordinance and his laws and the articles of our covenant with him, that we may live and be multiplied, and that the Lord our God may bless us in the land whither we go to possess it. But if our hearts turn away so that we will not obey, but shall be seduced and worship other gods, our pleasures and profits, and serve them, it is propounded unto us this day, we shall surely perish out of the good land, whether we pass over this vast sea to possess it. That's the covenant. That's the deal. You hang in there and do what you're supposed to do, you'll prosper. You don't, and you'll suffer. There's so much of history that comes out of this. This is the same community. This is 1630. 60 years later, in 1692, the Salem witch trials. This is a community that is used to the idea that God sends signs. God sends signals. If our society is not doing, our peoples are not doing what they're supposed to do, then God, in his infinite wisdom and love for us, sends witches among us. And basically what he's doing is testing us. Will we root out and hang these witches and punish this evil? And so this is a society that sees good times as meaning something and sees bad times as meaning something. And there's no question that our society, throughout its history, at least elements within it, have continued to do that. I mean, how many times can I say it? I'm reminded of a story that Bob Kincaid told me the other night out of a newspaper in California, but it fits very well. There was a story a few years ago after 9/11. Some of you may remember when Reverend Jerry Falwell, who has since passed away, made the comment that 9/11 is an indication that the Lord has turned his back on America because America condones homosexuality and all that goes with it. Pat Robertson one time in one of his sermons several years ago made the statement that we need to pray hurricanes away from the coast. This is based on the same implication that God actively intervenes in our day-to-day life and is constantly sending us messages and rewarding us for good behavior and punishing us for bad behavior, etc. And of course, the story that Bob Kincaid told me is that an Episcopal minister in California put a letter in the paper in response to Jerry Falwell's thing and said, God didn't turn his back on America with 9/11. He was just too busy winning high school football games. And, I mean, if you hear the Olympics, you know what I mean. You know, the first thing I want to do is, God's number one priority is that I win the Olympics. But the next question is, you mean that God's against all the people who didn't win? You know, and you got, I mean, the point I'm trying to make is you got some issues here. But this is big because this is a major element in American society. And we have to recognize it because it persists through. This is the idea of American exceptionalism. So what you've got is you've got the mission, you've got the covenant, and you've got the emphasis on community. Some of the major changes in America that we've already looked at. Bob Bliss the other night talked about the rights that Americans did, that Englishmen didn't have in 1600. And they become the rights that are granted to colonists in order to lure them, in order to encourage them to come to the New World, to populate the colonies. The colonies can't make money for the financial interests that bankroll them unless the colonies are populated. So you got to encourage people to come here. And one of the ways you can do it is by granting them rights that maybe they didn't have in the mother country. So the fact of the matter is that out of the colonial period where these rights have been granted, and the question that I asked Bob Bliss the other night is, so 150 years later or so, when Jefferson says we hold these truths to be self-evident, he's talking about rights that have become so common to everybody that everybody assumes that they're self-evident, that just everybody has these because they're human. Everybody who's a human being who lives in a civilized society ought to have these rights to free speech, free press, religious freedom, etc., etc., etc. And Jefferson can say that they are self-evident, and nobody challenges that. And so, in a sense, that makes us an exceptional society because we are a society committed to the rights of the people and the best interests of the people in it. Now, every society is going to say that they are. Syria, the Syrian government right now, the Assad government, is slaughtering its own people. And they're claiming that these are nothing but rebels and troublemakers and communists and terrorists and everything else, and that what I'm doing is trying to protect the good people of Syria by eliminating the bad people of Syria. So every government claims that it's got the best interests of the people at heart. But ours is probably the one more than any others that specifies the rights they have and has set up a whole system of jurisprudence basically prioritizing many of those rights like free speech and free press and freedom of assembly and all the rest of it. So much of the story of America that follows comes out of this document, of this concept of American exceptionalism. And it's pretty obvious why many people believe that, you know, that God ordained this nation. And it's a direct extension of this Puritan document. And so finally, Winthrop ends with this thing and says, therefore, let us choose life that we and our seed, in other words, those that follow us, may live by obeying his voice and cleaving to him. For he is our life and our prosperity. So this is a God-fearing, God-respecting community, which is on a mission to literally set up God's ideal community, with the mission being that we will be a city on a hill. Once we pull this off, everybody will see God's plan and see what God wants. This is, oh, that's the way God intended it. That's what God wants all of us to do. And the world will reform itself in our example. And I would suggest to you, and this is probably what makes me a liberal. You know, I am. I admit it. I think. But basically, because I believe we are exceptional. And I believe that we are the only nation in the world that is committed to doing the kinds of things that actually can make people's standard of living and quality of life better. So I'm not interested in freezing us in the past. I'm not comfortable with looking at the Constitution as if it was in concrete and fixed and was never changed, and the only rights we have are the rights that the founders thought we had. I am much more comfortable looking at the Constitution as a blueprint, as a very vague, general outline of what we ought to do that conforms to the priorities and the consistency of what this republic is about, and gives us the flexibility to make the changes and adjust to the challenges that make it possible to fulfill the ideals and the promises of the founders. And in order to do that, you've got to be an activist. You've got to look out for things that can be better. It doesn't mean that you're negative and you attack everything that's wrong with America. That's not it. The idea is you try to find things that you can make better. You give to charities. You become a good citizen. You volunteer your time. You offer things. And I believe that that is very consistent with what makes America as, you know, an exceptional nation, a nation that has a special mission. But where we get off mark sometimes is in some of the ways that others look at this idea of exceptionalism and mission. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but oftentimes, let me just give you just a couple of examples. I've got some quotes here I want to share with you. Let me give you just a couple of examples here. From rather modern, it's recent examples rather than going all the way back too far. For those of you that are well read around World War II, one of the biggest issues, during the 30s, during the rise of Adolf Hitler in Germany, was the role of the Catholic Church in Germany. And many people, after World War II, criticized Pope Pius XII, who was the Pope. And the argument was that while all of this horrible, inhuman destruction of 6 million Jews was happening in the Holocaust, the Pope and the Catholic Church looked the other way. And that the Church's number one priority was to protect the welfare of God's people. And to allow the extermination of 6 million Jews and just look the other way is to condone it. And to condone it is a violation of everything that the Church and the Pope are supposed to be about. So if you read the literature on the Church and on Pope Pius XII during that period, the argument was that Hitler posed the threat to destroy the Catholic Church. And the Pope's number one objective, priority, is to preserve the Church. So that long after Hitler was gone, the Church would continue to meet the spiritual needs of the flock. So the Pope made the judgment call that the most important thing was to protect the Church rather than go out in front and object to Hitler and allow them to destroy the Church. So in a sense, the messenger becomes more important than the message. That was one of the criticisms of World War II. More, I'm not against the Catholic Church here, but there's two classic examples. The most recent one, obviously, is the abuse of young children. That, you know, that we are seeing over the last several years, that the church tended to look, Catholic Church tended to look the other way. I don't want people to leave and say, boy, he indicated how awful the Catholic Church is. You know, this is the one we know about. But it's clear that what happened is the church's number one priority became not the concern for the victims of this abuse, but the protection of the church. And so the church, many of the bishops and many of the cardinals moved priests around from parish to parish so that the people in the new parish wouldn't know that they had been accused of child abuse in the old parish, and they just inflicted them on a whole new group of people and their kids. And now the church is paying for it. And the most recent example of all of this is Joe Paterno at Penn State. And the Free Report basically said, at Penn State, Joe Paterno's reputation and football became more important than the victims of this abuser. And Penn State and Joe Paterno consciously made the decision to not go public with this and not to go after this guy because the embarrassment would cost Penn State and cost Penn State recruits. Again, the missionary, the deliverer of the message, becomes more important than the message. That tends to be one of the major problems with institutions. Institutions, by definition, are man-made entities that are created to provide a service, to do something, to accomplish something. But almost all the time, institutions tend to become ends in themselves rather than means to an end. Every institution, by definition, becomes more important than the reason for which it was created. And the argument is, it's more important to not risk the future of the institution. So let's not make an issue of this. Let's sacrifice those victims in favor of the people we can help later on by preserving the institution, whether it's the church, whether it's whatever, or whether it's the nation. Because nationally, people say, America, right or wrong, you've got to support us. Whatever we do in the defense of our nation is legitimate, because the most important thing is preserving our nation, because our nation is on a mission to reform the world. So therefore, we might have to do some things that look bad in the short term, but in the long term, it's the right thing to do. And so what you get is this whole America, love it or leave it, you're with us or against us, if you criticize us, you need to go, etc., etc., etc. There's absolutely no question, just to get very, very local and very, very contemporary, there's absolutely no question, if you've been reading the paper about Mountain State University here, there's no question that that's what happened with the Board of Governors up there. Charlie Polk, the president up there, was going through board members like people go through popcorn until he got ended a bunch of people on there that would just do what he wanted. And the argument is that the institution can do good things, but the institution must always make the decisions. And it becomes more important than the people it serves. And you can see these students that have accumulated incredible amounts of debt and have credits that aren't worth anything and won't transfer anywhere, degrees that aren't worth anything. In many cases, their lives are probably ruined. I mean, I know people that are leaving there that are due to graduate that are $70,000 and $80,000 in debt, some of these health programs, PA, physician's assistants, for example. Effectively, they have a mortgage, but they didn't get the house. And they're going to spend the rest of their lives paying off a mortgage, and they have no house. So, in a sense, it's easy to shift and make means ends. You know what I'm saying? It's very hard to keep your priorities straight. So the Puritans, Winthrop, for example, one of the most classic examples is Robert Kane in Puritan Boston, very successful businessman. And he was condemned by the church. And he said, all I've done is be successful. I'm a successful businessman. I've made money. I'm providing for my family. I'm improving the quality of life of all the people around me because I have a buying and selling. And what their argument is, he was charging exorbitant prices and he was monopolizing the supply so people couldn't get it from anywhere else except him. And he was playing all the modern games. This is in 1635. And basically what he was doing was fixing the market and stacking the deck in order to benefit himself. And he said, I'm making money. God obviously must be happy with something I'm doing. I must be doing right. And their argument is to look at your own success and to dwell on it and brag about it is the worst thing you can do. Because what that means is you aren't seeing what God is really doing. God is rewarding people for what they do for everybody else, not themselves. The strength of community, the Puritans would argue, is taking the success that God is kind enough and loving enough to allow you to have and using it for the benefit of the rest of the community. That's the mission. That's the message that Matthew gave us in the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. What is the message here about American exceptionalism? Seems to me it's one of the most important concepts, and it's something that we constantly have to wrestle with and we constantly have to reflect on. Because we are being told by different people that America is exceptionable for different reasons. I'm just taking modern politics here. I'm not attacking anybody. But Mitt Romney is telling us that America is special because it allowed him to get rich. And what he is saying is what makes America great is because it permits some people to become fabulously wealthy. And the idea is that the old message of the idea, in other words, what they've done is they've taken the mission part of Winthrop's speech, but they have ignored and intentionally forgotten about the community part. The issue here is what we're talking about, a society that puts the emphasis on the individual, on individual freedom, on the rights of the individual, the freedom of the individual. I have the right to say this. I have the right to do this. I have the right to do this. I have the right to do whatever I want to do in my property. If you live next door to me and you don't like it, the hell with you, move. And there's no sense of community responsibility or obligation or responsibility to other people in the community. And this is one of the greatest challenges that America faces, is to maintain the sense of community and at the same time preserve the benefits of individual freedom which allow us to do this. And then you get to the question, does that mean that the only way we can proceed and fulfill this mission of exceptionalism and community strength is create a society which does all it can do to allow as many people as possible to prosper to whatever extent their abilities and their talents will take them. And then take the fabulous success of the few and make that available to the people at the bottom that didn't make it. What we're talking about here is redistributing income. We call it communism. Community. Communism. This afternoon, this morning, Willis Nordlund talked about Samuel Gompers and the American Federation of Labor. And he pointed out that the American Federation of Labor was an organization, was a union of craft unions, craftsmen, specialists. And along came an organization called the Knights of Labor. And Willis made the point and said the Knights of Labor set out to organize everybody. The AFL wouldn't take anybody but the specialists, the crafts, the craftsmen, the artisans. The CIO was the organization of industrial workers. These are the people with lower skills. And then, and he did, there's no way he had time to get into this, but then he said, the Knights of Labor didn't do that well. It didn't last that long. But the AFL experienced some success, and their membership swelled. I'm going to ask you to think of something. Why do you think that the AFL was successful in union organizing and winning, you know, wage improvements and working hours and safety, workplace safety and all of those other things, and the Knights of Labor was not? And if you think about it, it's pretty obvious. If we're going to, by we, I'm talking about employers now, corporations. If we're going to be faced with the threat of unionism, better the AFL than the Knights of Labor. Because the AFL doesn't want to challenge free enterprise. All they want is a bigger piece of the pie. They want higher wages. They want time and a half for overtime. They want safe working and conditions and safer living conditions. They want education for their kids. They want an education for their kids so their kids can be successful. That's not a threat to capitalism. That is capitalism. So if we're going to be faced with unions, better a union that stands for that than somebody like the AFL is trying to organize everybody and take over and possibly destroy the free enterprise system like the IWW, like the Wobblies, the International Workers of the World. And these groups, these radical groups that don't buy into the free enterprise system but challenge it, become the basis of what Marx proposed as socialist, as communist. And so our society is built around the idea of free enterprise, individual freedom, individual opportunity, and success. If you don't provide opportunity, if you don't give people an opportunity to make it, once they become convinced that they don't have a chance, then what do you do when you realize that it's hopeless and you just can't make it? You're paying a $2,000 a month mortgage payment and your income is $1,600 a month. And you owe 20 years on your house. And you struggle and you try to do a second job and maybe you try, you know, maybe your wife goes to work. Maybe you try to send the kids out to work. But gradually you begin to realize, hell, the best thing to do is just in the middle of the night, just lock up this place and leave. What the hell with it? We can't make it. We can't do it. If too many people conclude that, the system doesn't work. So you got to have opportunity. You've got to be able to offer people an opportunity to do better. And as long as you can do that, our system is secure. But when you get large numbers of people that conclude, this game is unfair, the hell with it, I'm not playing. I don't care whether I get a job or not. My number one priority is to get on the system and get a check. And let somebody else take care of it. Nobody stars in this society. If I get sick and go into the emergency room, somebody will pay the health care. Somebody will pay the hospital, even if I can't. When you get to the point where more and more of your people are at the point where they don't think the system is fair, then ultimately the system itself becomes, then they begin to look around and they begin to unite with other people who feel the same way. Then you got a movement that continues. That's where this, I think that's where the debate over what's happening right now with the election is critical. Because there are many people looking out right now and they're seeing these fabulous bonuses that these Wall Street firms are paying and all of this stuff. And these fabulous millionaires. People with money are making money. And people without it can't find jobs. And what we are seeing is large numbers of people. The whole idea of the middle class was you become middle class with the idea that there's opportunities there, you might make upper class. But now what's happening is the middle class is dropping into the lower class, into the working class. And the working class is dropping into the level of the unemployed. And that creates problems for the society. So my point is, I'm not here to talk politics necessarily. What I'm basically trying to point out is, America is an exceptional nation, I believe. It probably is not exceptional for some of the reasons that we have experienced. Let me just go back. This is all, you teach history. You've seen some of this stuff. Jefferson, if you remember the title of Gordon Wood's book, Empire for Liberty. Jefferson believed that the availability of the West provided land, the Louisiana Purchase. That created opportunities for people to become landowners for generations to come. The idea being that you never have a revolution in the society because if people aren't making it, they go west. But at the end of the 19th century, there's no more west to go to. The nation, there's no frontier left. Frederick Jackson Turner in the frontier thesis. And he said the frontier is what held this nation together. The fact that everybody could go west and start again and have a new, the idea that there was opportunity available, land available and all that, that's what made this society go. That's what made hard work rewarded and, rewarded hard work and all this other stuff. What do we do now? That's the point at which America's foreign policy begins to go overseas and we begin to see trade and the idea that we can keep our people working by finding overseas markets and making sure that more people around the world wanted frigid airs. But now what we've got with technology is they're being made over there rather than here. This is the problem. So there aren't any jobs here. So, it's really significant. So the point I'm trying to make is we are exceptional. But some of the examples, Jefferson and the Empire, Jefferson's argument is that by expanding into the West, we are expanding freedom. And the whole implication is that freedom only matters if there's opportunity connected. If there's no opportunity to better yourself, then what good is freedom? Andrew Jackson and the removal of the Indians, the Trail of Tears, and the opening up of all of that land in the Southwest for settlers. In other words, the rationale that we use to displace and remove Native Americans in order to make that land available, because God believes, many people use this rationale, that God wants the world wants the earth to go to those who will make the best use of it. In the 1840s, we go to war with Mexico, and the emergence of the term coined by John O'Sullivan in 1845 manifests destiny. It is our destiny to own Texas. O'Sullivan says, "The right to overspread and to possess the whole of the American continent, which Providence has given us for the development of the great experiment of liberty and federated self-government entrusted to us." In other words, we have a right to Texas and California and Hawaii and Cuba because we are expanding freedom. George Bush in 2003 when the shock and awe in Iraq. Our goal is to establish an Iraqi democracy in the middle of the Middle East. We are expanding freedom into an area of the world that doesn't have it. We are fulfilling the mission. We are bringing freedom to the world. William Seward, Seward's Folly, Alaska, Secretary of State under Lincoln, a poem. Abroad, our empire shall no limits know, but like the sea in boundless circles, the whole world is potentially ours. And I mentioned the other night, there's a beautiful letter. I was trying to find it, and I couldn't. There's a beautiful letter about if God in His infinite wisdom suspended the laws of gravity, Cuba would float right into the Gulf of Mexico and snuggle up to the Texas coast where it belongs. Therefore, it is ours. Social Darwinism in the late 19th century. Which nations have the highest quality standard of living? Which nations don't? The ones that are at the top are white. The ones that aren't are non-white. Conclusion. The white races are superior to the non-white races. Conclusion. Western culture is superior to non-Western. Conclusion, Mitt Romney in Jerusalem. The Israelis are profiting because of the superiority of their culture. The implication, the Palestinians are suffering because their culture. And nothing. Americans, we work. Americans work hard. Americans aren't looking for a handout, etc., etc., etc. I would suggest to you that this is not consistent with the mission. So I'm not questioning American exceptionalism. I'm asking people to reflect on it and look at it very carefully and define it very carefully. Because American exceptionalism is very, very important. Because this nation is committed to things that no other nation in the history of the world is committed to. And I would suggest to you, I feel, that the ultimate example of good citizenship is to basically do all we can personally to allow us to fulfill this mission. But on the other hand, I don't believe that gives us the right to look down on other cultures, look down on other religions, look down on other races, or whatever. And it seems to me that when you look at these modules that you've got on citizenship, it really requires some thinking and some reflection on the nature of citizenship. It used to be that the idea is the whole definition of good citizenship is voting, trying to be as intelligent, knowing the issues, knowing the candidates, voting intelligently, etc. That was the definition of it. I would suggest to you that that's one of the drawbacks, if you will, to the very limited, narrow, shallow definition of citizenship that a lot of people create. But when you think of what this society is about, when you think of the commitment to the rights no other society in the history of the world ever was committed to, when you think of the fact that it is America's commitments to these rights that set off the French Revolution, that set off revolutions in Latin America, and Asia, and everywhere else. Basically, we're on to something. But how we do it, it seems to me, is vitally important. We are right now, in this particular political season, in a crisis over that mission. Because we are being told, we are being encouraged to believe that commitment to community is contrary to our mission. What I'm trying to suggest is, damn it, it is our mission. And that to me is the most important thing that we need to look at. As we look at American foreign policy as it develops and what we're trying to do, it seems to me that this is absolutely one of the most important issues. This may be one of the most important documents in American history. And again, all you have to do is read it. You can stand up there and lecture. amount of doomsday to students about community, and you can define it. You can go to Webster and pull out a definition. You can do all of that stuff. But I'm telling you, when kids read this, they know what community is. You can understand this. This is what community is. This is not communism in the negative, in the communist Russian dictator sense. This is the idea that freedom matters only when you can use it to the benefit not of just yourself, but everybody else. And if everybody does that, we all float. If nobody does it, the vast majority of us sink. And I think right now that's where we are. That's where we're in the midst of that. And unfortunately, I don't think a lot of people realize what the issues are. To me, those are the issues. And I think it's particularly important. And I, again, Jay Leno comes on in a few minutes. It's just gone 8 years. Does anybody have any questions or comments? I mean, if you think I'm an idiot, that's fine. Maybe there was a little bit more in my crab cakes than I thought. But anyway, I appreciate the opportunity because I really think that this is vitally important. Anybody want to make comments? Yeah, go right ahead, Susan. Exactly. That's what it is. The public enemy. The preamble to the Constitution talks about promoting the general welfare. And the key issue is, what is the general welfare? Is the general welfare a society that allows me to get rich? Or is the general welfare the idea that a society that allows me to get rich encourages me to realize that the most important thing I can do with that is to basically give it back to the community that helped me do it? You know, that's the issue. And so, I feel that, we're in a situation, for example, I'm using political examples and I can't help it. But it seems to me, when you make profit and your number one priority is to make sure that you don't pay taxes on that, Alexander Hamilton, in the Federalist Papers, and especially in the ratification struggle in New York, Alexander Hamilton made the comment that taxes are the way that you tie all the citizens together. What that means is we all contribute to the common good. So, and that's what that's why people pay their taxes. Because they figure it's fair. And we have, in this system, we adopted something we call the progressive system of taxation, which is basically the idea that the people who make the most pay the most because they have the most to give back. And so the rates go up. But this is a real word, we've bastardized that system because what we've done through loopholes and interest groups and lobbyists and all the rest of it is we have provided loopholes. And there's nothing wrong with loopholes, allowing people to deduct the interest they pay in their mortgage is not a loophole. It encourages home ownership, which is what makes our system go, is people seek to own their own home and maybe get a bigger home. And the idea is, by allowing them to deduct their mortgage on their taxes, their mortgage payments, the interest on their mortgage on their taxes, that basically encourages home ownership. And that's what, we have a nation predominantly of property owners. And that creates a conservative, stable nation. That's what we want. If all the property is owned by 1% of the people, we get a bad situation. And so there are loopholes. And the problem with the loophole system we created is most people don't know about it or can't take advantage of it. Only the very wealthy can hire the legal brains to find the loopholes and say, this is what you do, this is where you stash your money, and you do this and you do that. And you buy into this stock. because this company is going to go, this company is going to lose money, and you can claim that as a loss on your taxes. So buy this stock. And part of this mess that happened from 2008 on was exactly this, what Goldman Sachs did. Goldman Sachs was selling stocks, and then they were selling preferred customers, encouraging preferred customers to buy stock in the fact that the companies they were supporting were going to go bankrupt. They were betting against their own clients, but only preferred customers knew it. So I'm Goldman Sachs, and I'm giving you advice on how to invest your resources as a company. And I'm telling my friends, invest in such and such because they're going to go bankrupt. And they're going to go bankrupt because of the advice that I'm giving them. So by me giving them advice that causes them to go bankrupt, we make money. That's what happened in 2008. Good God. The Puritans would, we would have been hanging them up and down the street, up and down Wall Street, in 1630. Because this is not only not doing the best interests of the community, this is taking advantage of the ignorance of the people in your own community. The most vulnerable people. And that totally violates this idea. So again, the question is individual freedom and responsibility. What are the responsibilities that go with freedom? People talk about my rights all the time, but they don't talk that often about their responsibilities and what they're supposed to do with those rights. And John Winthrop told us, he didn't just tell us we were an exceptional nation, go for it. He also said we are an exceptional nation because we have a responsibility to do this. And if we do the opposite, we're going to pay for it. We may be paid. We may be paid. But that, the common good, public interest, the key is not the common good. The key is what the common good is or who defines it. In other words, I can say the common good is to give back and, benefit those that don't have as much as me, as I do. Or I can say the common good is for me to stash money in the Cayman Islands so I don't have to pay taxes. And that may be, for me, the individual, the best thing to do. It's the public interest. It's in my best interest. But is it in the best interest of the community you live in? Only if you believe that the public, and that's what, if you read Madison's Federalist Number 10 carefully, what Madison is suggesting, he talks about factions and they're sewn into the nature of man and all of this stuff, but then he says, the citizens, the most considerate and virtuous citizens, the best people, are saying these laws are unfair and blah, 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 and we've got to do this and we've got to. He said, who are these people, these considerate and virtuous citizens? I thought everybody was driven by self-interest and factions were sown into the nature of man. Except them? And then you begin to say, the only thing you can conclude is they believe that their interests are my interests. And they have decided that I don't understand that, but they do. And so they have decided that the public interest, the best thing for me, is for them to make as much money as they can. And that's the way they define the public interest. And that's what I would suggest to you, that's one of the decisions that's going to be on the table at this coming election, as to whether, in fact, that is the public interest or not. And I'll be honest with you, I think it's probably going to end up to be. I'm concerned. But that is really, that is really what's going on here. And so, in a sense, what Willis was talking about today, about the AFL and Knights of Labor, that's a classic example. Because what the Knights of Labor was out to do was organize everybody who works. And if you get everybody who works into one group, you got power. Madison called that the majority faction. That's the biggest threat to our system because once the majority gets control, Madison said it's over. So the way to keep that from happening is to allow a less dangerous alternative to gain a little success, which allows it to draw some members, have some successes, and basically it doesn't pose a threat to the system. All they want is to be part of it, is to get a bigger piece of the action. And so that's not radical. That's shrewd conservative, if you think about it. It's, in fact, Theodore Roosevelt said that. Roosevelt, when he was talking about the monopolies in the early 20th century, Roosevelt made the comment and said, you know, my friends in business, corporate leaders, are telling me that I'm a radical. He said, this isn't radical. This is the shrewdest form of conservatism. I'm preserving the system. Because if you allow the system to monopolize the wealth in fewer and fewer hands and allow the masses to lose their jobs and drop into the levels of the unemployed, you've got a revolution. The only way that the system can work is when maximum numbers of citizens are benefiting from it. When you set up the rules in such a way that only a few can win, and that happens all the time, and people conclude that it really isn't fair, I'm not going to play it. Once too many people decide not to play anymore, we're in trouble.
And that, for about the last hour and 17 minutes, has been Dr. Bill O'Brien and his seminal exposition on American exceptionalism. Dr. Bill will join. Will begin, with any luck, his new show tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific. It will be podcasted, and it will be on the rerun stream. And I think it will... Well, if you spend time with Dr. Bill, you will walk away vastly more intelligent or more informed. Intelligence is native. Vastly more informed than you were to begin with. This is the kind of professorship that people pay thousands of dollars for. And because of the philosophy of the horn, it is being put out there for nothing more than the time it takes you to engage. That's pretty profound. Also, with the addition of Dr. Bill, the horn will be going back to what we did some several years ago. We will be offering 8 hours a day of live conversation-based radio unlike any other. So many thanks to all of you. Thanks especially to those of you who contribute both your time and your funds to keep all of this going. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky, and Texas Betsy in the chat room, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to Agnes for help with the posts. Thanks to John Fox. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the people at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and ACHEACT.org. If you go to ACHEACT.org, you can learn how you can go about being a part of the end of the agony that besets Appalachia, how you can be a part of helping us pass the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
And now, here comes Rick Smith, live on the horn.